We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Craig is usually a fan of water cooler talk, but it's draft season, and that's all anyone wants to talk about. The Athletic has loads of articles about this year's draft. But Greg doesn't have The Athletic, so now he's filling up his water bottle in the bathroom sink. Which, to remind you, is the sink people use after they use the bathroom. Get The Athletic and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.
From brand new Pod World Headquarters, this is the Carolina Insider from Learfield IMG College.
Darkness, my old friend.
We're back. Time for another edition of the Carolina Insider. I've come to talk with you again. Jones and Adam here with you.
Because a vision softly creeping.
Adam.
Left its seeds while I was sleeping.
Everything's wrong.
And the vision that was planted in my brain.
Yes.
Still remains within the sound.
We'll look back to this past weekend. We will have a good guest, John Kuster, former Tar Heel in the mid to late 70s. Went on to a long coaching career, both in college and the NBA, including being the head coach of the Detroit Pistons for a couple seasons. Has won NBA titles as an assistant coach, has worked with some great players. We talk about all of that with John, so we're looking forward to that coming up in a little bit. Adam will have some form of a list and more.
You really sold that.
So, Adam, of course, Tar Heels falling to Clemson in overtime, 79-76 in the Smith Center on Saturday. And there just so much disappointment, I think, coming out of that game. And not so much necessarily that Carolina lost to Clemson at home, which, of course, had never happened. And, yes, that's a bummer. And, yes, it was a great streak and all those things. But, eventually Clemson was going to win at some point. But Adam, it was the way that it happened that was so disheartening. Carolina controlled the game, really, for 38 minutes. Played well. Had a 10-point lead. Had a great outing by Brandon Robinson, scoring the ball. And the Tar Heels were up 10 with 2:08 to go, and then absolutely melted down. And outscored 12-2 in the final, 2:08. Multiple turnovers leading to Clemson being able to get back in it. Amir Sims made 9 of the 12 points for the Tigers in that run, including the game-tying 3 that sent it to overtime, and then Clemson wins in the extra period. And, Adam, it was just stunning to see. You never see Carolina do that. Never. And that's not to say Carolina's never lost a lead. Of course, the Tar Heels have in their history. But you never see them break down the way they broke down in the final 2 minutes. And, man, just a disappointing day, disappointing end to the day where I thought there had been some encouraging things for Carolina in the previous 38 minutes of regulation.
It was almost as though, like, it was hard to know how to write about it, and I'm sure how to talk about it, and certainly how to talk about it now, because two different things happened. The first 38 minutes, you could have said, well, the Tar Heel defense looked a little better, and that's one of the areas we've said needs to improve, and they played better in the first 38 minutes. There were times where the five players on the court appeared to be moving together and looked like they were communicating and diving on the floor and just playing better defense. But then the final two of regulation plus five of overtime, some of those old problems came up again, and Clemson got too many layups and got free too often. And I think first 38 minutes, Leaky Black pressed into service as the starting point guard because of yet another injury to another potential starting point guard, was solid, fine, not spectacular, but managed the game, put Carolina in position to win. But then the final 2 minutes of regulation and 5 minutes of overtime were not good. Brandon Robinson had a great game, 27 points, did absolutely everything Carolina needed him to do. But then The final two minutes of regulation and 5 minutes of overtime were not as good. So it's just hard to know where to go from there. And a lot of times when Carolina has these comebacks and then you think back on them, you think, man, it's unbelievable how every single one of those things had to happen in order to enable that comeback to happen. Well, that's what happened in reverse. If the Tar Heels could have just done one thing differently, just on one possession, one thing differently, it probably doesn't happen that way. But it all did happen that way.
Yeah, even going back to the end of the first half where Carolina plays great defense on the final possession and the ball just happens to bounce right to, I believe it was Dawes for Clemson, who hits a three at the buzzer.
Anytime the other team hits a three-pointer at the end of the first half in absurd fashion, you just need to go out to your car and leave the game because that team's going to somehow win in the stupidest fashion possible because of that dumb shot. Every single darn time. If that happens, just turn the TV off. It's not going to end well.
A couple things. One basketball related and then one more off the court. Basketball-wise, Adam, Carolina has to figure out how to play better against the press because I thought it had gotten a little better since UCLA, but then when it mattered the most, the Tar Heels could not effectively move the ball against Clemson's press and ended up with 10 turnovers. I think four of them came in that last 2 minutes in overtime. I think that's right. And It just killed him. Killed him.
And I think there's two separate parts to handling the press. There's the technical X's and O's part where throwing it to the right person at the right spot, that hasn't always been great. But then there's just the mental side of just looking like you want no part of it and not being willing to attack it. You can't beat the press by going backwards or even really sideways. You have to be willing to attack it and be excited about the fact that they're probably going to give you a layup if you execute correctly. And Carolina looked the opposite of that in the final 2 minutes. And as we've talked about a million times, it's on film now. And anyone who has any sort of press in the ACC is loading that up for the Tar Heels to come to town. Clemson probably went home going, man, we should have been doing that the whole time. And we wouldn't have had to come back. Because Carolina just didn't handle it very well. Now, again, you don't have Cole Anthony. You don't have Jeremiah Francis. That's your two primary press breakers. You think Clemson's going to press Cole Anthony? Probably not. But you're up 10 with 2 minutes left. You need to be able to manage it in such a way that you win that game regardless of what defense they are using against you.
The other off the court type of thing is just where are the Tar Heels mentally? Because that's a devastating loss. They have to sit on it for a week. And I do think the pressure of the season has weighed on Carolina and at the end of these last two games. Carolina played well enough for most of the game against Pitt and Clemson to win the game. And didn't do it because of failure at the end of the games. And I do think that pressure of just how this year has gone has added to that. So, man, it's going to be a challenge, I'm sure. And that's not to say that, you know, the guys aren't going to try hard or anything. I just think it's hard to bounce back from a loss like that, especially when you're feeling it a little bit the way the year has gone to this point.
I think the clearest way to see what you're talking about is the demeanor of Garrison Brooks, our little gerb. He looks, after games when he's answering questions from the media, exactly like Jason Capel circa 2002 and Marcus Guignard circa 2010. He just looks like it's overwhelming and demoralizing and soul-crushing, because I'm sure it probably is. And both those people we just named who were his predecessors, we like and were great representatives of Carolina basketball, and we've had Marcus Guignard on here. But it's just a lot when you know every minute of every day someone's basically blaming you for Carolina basketball not being what it's been for 70 years. That's the rest of us get to go off and do whatever we do with our lives. That is their lives. That is what they do all the time, players and coaches alike. You never get away from it. Everything you do has got some kind of reminder of that and the fact that you are responsible for it. And that's a lot. And that's why I think Roy Williams was so emotional after the game, because he knew they just needed something good to happen, just to feel good for a couple days. In this case, it's 6 days, to be able to feel good about yourself and not feel like it's drudgery to have to come to the Smith Center every single day. Because now you pull up and you think, ugh, what can happen now? Whereas if you can just win that game, you get a couple days of, all right, guys, we got a shot. And, I mean, this is foolish to say. The next game Carolina plays is at Pitt. There's absolutely no reason Carolina can't beat Pitt. The only way Pitt beat Carolina is they went out of their minds shooting the ball. The odds of them shooting the ball like that again are not very good. But now you're more demoralized than you were when you played them the first time, and you're not the same team either. So it's a challenging portion of the basketball season right now.
Yeah, and I think Carolina, to your point, having something good happen, because I do think if they win that game, we're sitting here and we're talking about, man, Brandon Robinson, hit some big threes. Great to see him step up. Armando Bacot had gone through that stretch where he didn't play very well, but he's bounced back with a bunch of good games now. He had 21 points, 5 rebounds, 2 blocks, hit his free throws, got good, you know, spacing in the post, all those things.
Garrison Brooks, 4 straight double-doubles.
Yeah, Andrew Playtech starting and had a very solid game. 8 points, 8 rebounds, 6 assists. I mean, there were things there that if you just win it, you sit here and you go, man, look, see, guys, this is what Coach Williams was talking about on Monday, about playing together, executing the energy level. This is what he was talking about when he brought John Kuster to midcourt at practice and said, you know, this is a guy who, you know, left it all out there, whatever it was that he said. You still can build off all those things, but it's so much better to build off of it winning the game. A very obvious statement. But it's harder to see when the results aren't there. I asked Coach Williams when we were shooting the TV show a couple days ago. I said, Coach, you keep talking about your team making improvement. That's your goal right now. I said, outside of wins and losses, how do you see improvement? Or how do you measure improvement? Something along those lines. And he said, you do it. Yes, he said, but it's hard to do when you don't get the ultimate result. So were there a lot of things better? Yes, there were a lot of things better, but it's without the result, it's hard to embrace it.
I think it'll be interesting to see, and by the time this comes out, you will have talked to Coach Williams last night at the radio show. It'll be interesting to see how he handles it with the team. Do you show him those 38 minutes and go, guys, this is what I was talking about. This is exactly what I was talking about. For 38 out of 40 minutes, you look like a capable basketball team. Because he's been in more Hall of Fames than me just by a narrow margin. I don't think you can focus on those last 7 minutes with them. I think they get it. They're demoralized by it. No one knows it better than they do.
Adam, that does take us to Coach Williams very pointedly putting the blame for the loss on himself for his failure in his mind to remind the team to foul, that he wanted them to foul. Roy Williams was not, unless he changed the way that he handles things most times, he wasn't doing that in my mind to somehow take something off the team. He said what he believed. He has no ulterior motive. He's going in there and he's telling you what's on the forefront of his mind. And I think that's truly what he believed. And I am sorry that it happened, because I think Carolina would have rather fouled there. I mean, and obviously now you can say, of course they wanted to. But that's what he has traditionally believed in. We've talked about it before. He's talked about it before. That there's, I think it's 7 seconds maybe, or somewhere around there.
He thinks more than seven, you foul.
You foul.
Less than seven, he thinks you don't foul, because you run the risk of they fling up a shot as you're fouling, and either they get three free throws, or absolute worst case scenario, they make it and get one more free throw, then you could lose the game. So he typically has wanted his team to be pretty intentional. You let them get it to about midcourt to burn off some time, and then you foul them. And that's not what happened. And I think that was what was so surprising watching it unfold, because I think we've all been around him enough to know that that's what he wants to do. And so when the team wasn't fouling, I mean, Clemson just flat out ran exactly what they wanted to run with no resistance. It was like they were doing dummy offense. And as you watched it, you thought, this doesn't seem quite right. And then it became clear after the game, why not? I mean, what can you do? It's a mistake. He messed up and he owned it. I think there's a case to be made that there's also other people involved in those timeout huddles. And as the ball's being put in play, there's other people who have opportunities to say things. But ultimately, it stops with the head coach. And if he gets the credit for the wins, then he should take the blame for the mistakes. And that's exactly what he did. Walked right in there and said, it was me. And I don't think it really matters who says what about him or who's mean to him on the internet or whatever. You can't possibly be meaner to him than he is to himself.
Yeah, he looked absolutely, we've said demoralized, but he looked that way in the postgame.
And I don't think it, did that lose the game? Well, really, there were a lot of things that led up to that that didn't help either.
Yeah.
Carolina lost the game. That's how it works. Sometimes you lose the game. Sometimes you beat a team 59 times in a row, and the 60th is their day. But it would have been nice if it had been 61, but it wasn't. And I just don't know. I don't know what more can you expect him to do than to say he messed up. This is going to be darn close to it. How can you justify that?
Hey, guys, it's Jones. Just wanted to quickly step in. You heard Adam a second ago say that this was really close to a how can you justify that? What follows is perhaps the most heated Adam has ever gotten on the Carolina Insider podcast. So I'm going to jump in here with my editorial rights and retroactively call this a how can you justify that? So we're going to hit the music, and then we're going to proceed and just be ready. Here we go.
I do not have to justify.
How can you justify what you've done?
Can you possibly justify that?
It demoralizes me personally when Carolina goes through a rough stretch, either football or basketball or really anything, that some people have to show themselves in a way that is so unbecoming of them personally. If it mean, it's like they wait for Carolina to lose, and only then are they willing to engage or participate or make their opinions known. When Carolina's winning, you don't ever hear from these people. When they lose, oh, now I'm going to let you know what I think. This has been bothering me all along. Oh, did it? I don't remember that in 2017. I don't remember hearing from you. Why do you do it? Why do you do it? If only when they lose do you seem to be happy. That's not healthy for you. Dr. Adam says you need to find another hobby. It's supposed to be fun all the time, not fun when they lose, so that you can puff your chest out and say, well, when I coached Johnny's 7-year-old YMCA team, we went 8-3 and were the 3 seed in the playoffs because I used a zone defense. Well, I would like to extend my heartiest congratulations to you. It's completely different. It's like me calling up Zena Cardman and go, Zena, you know what? I saw that Space Camp movie, and I'm ready to come get in the spaceship and fly it to the moon. Because I watch friggin' Space Camp. So just let me know what time to be there. I know you've gone through all this training, and you've learned all these physics and science things. But I saw Space Camp. So just let me know when to be there, Houston. Fly me to the moon.
Sir, this is a Wendy.
I do feel a little better. If what you're doing as a hobby doesn't make you happy, just get another hobby. Just get another hobby. It's not worth it. It's not worth it. If you only get emotionally invested when something bad happens, you need to examine yourself.
I will say this. Something good is going to happen for Carolina at some point this year. And Adam, it's moments like these that make you feel even better for when the good stuff does happen. And I think also in a season that has not gone the way the Tar Heels want to this point, it should make you realize how rare this is for Carolina and how seasons like this happen much more regularly for other teams.
This is like being a fill in the blank with school who we could all think of fan. This is what normal sports is like. Carolina basketball is not normal sports, not in any way. And so that means, of course, you have higher expectations because that's what you're used to. But at the same time you have those expectations, you need to be able to look at what's happening and realize, oh, there's four guys sitting over there in suits who would be playing in this game. Clemson's an Atlantic Coast Conference team that gives out scholarships and tries to get good players. That was the edited version of what I have to say. You know what makes me the maddest? Is that when something good does happen, it almost makes you wish, it almost makes you feel like, well, some of these people don't deserve it. That's why Roy Williams says some of the things he says about how it matters to him more than anyone else. because of stuff like this. Why would I want something good to happen to some of these people who, of course, aren't pod listeners? In all truthfulness, I really don't think they are. You don't deserve it. Like, you're spoiled. You think someone owes you North Carolina basketball beating Clemson basketball. You think Brandon Robinson didn't want to beat Clemson basketball? You think Garrison Brooks went home and was like, well, that was no big deal. Nobody's more bothered than he is.
Yeah.
I was trying to be measured, like your last, how can you justify that? How'd I do?
Adam, should we go to our interview?
I like John Kuster. I respect him.
We had the opportunity to talk to John Kuster, again, former Tar Heel great, was on the 77 national runner-up team, long time in the NBA as well as a coach, and coaching college some as well, and some really neat stories. And I really enjoyed, as you'll hear in just a second, he's coached with Allen Iverson and LeBron James and had a chance to talk to him about some of those guys and what makes them different than your traditional high-level basketball player, and just some good stuff coming up from John Kuster. So we'll get to that. Come back. I'll cool, see if we can cool Adam down a little bit. Talk about his grandkids. Before we do that, a reminder that it's time for our Champions of the Court highlight MVP from the previous game, brought to you by UNC Healthcare, dedicated to caring for champions of all kinds to help keep you in the game and at your very best. See their lineup at unchealthcare.org/sports. Man, Brandon Robinson, 27 points, 4 assists, 4 steals as well. Terrific game. Mentioned Armando Bacot, 21 points, 5 boards, 2 blocks, double-double for Garrison Brooks. Good minutes from Playtech. Leaky Black, 5 points, 6 rebounds, 5 assists, solid. But as we said, all these things tough just because it didn't end the way the Tar Heels wanted, of course. But we still have more to do. Let's get to our conversation with John Kuster. Come back here on the Carolina Insider.
Our guest today has had a very successful playing career at North Carolina, played in the NBA, spent a lifetime in the game of basketball, and yet podcast listeners will probably know him first because, according to Dave Hanners, John Kuster owes his playing time in the 8 points in 17 seconds game to the fact that Dave Hanners couldn't get off his warm-up pants. So thanks so much for coming by to clear that up for us.
No, it's interesting. I've known Dave pretty much my entire life, especially from Carolina as a freshman on. And, you know, it's interesting. Dave Hanners was – people don't realize how talented he was. He didn't get all the playing time that a lot of people received. But what a competitor. What a young man that, had so much ability. I was very fortunate to have him as a teammate. I have watched him as a coach do amazing things. And having said that, the one thing that he just didn't learn how to do was take off his pants quick enough. But as long as I've known Dave, really, it's funny. This was the truly the first year that I've heard that story. Okay, because I know I took off mine real quick. And it's really interesting the number of people that remember that particular game. I mean, I was a freshman. Walter was a freshman. And we had Kupchak also during that time. And to have been a part of one of the greatest comebacks of all time was a true honor.
What do you remember about that game and that sequence and the huddles and just everything that happened?
Well, it's very similar probably to what Dave said, except for I took my pants off quicker. The thing that occurred that I remember is, hearing Coach Smith after every sequence that occurred, I can't do the sequence probably like what actually happened, but I remember after one timeout, Coach Smith saying, hey, we're in a great spot. don't, you know, we're going to go in and we're going to go steal the ball. We're going to get a layup, call another timeout. And that was one of the things that you found out about Coach Smith, is his ability to save those timeouts, to understand when to use them. And we used every timeout in that situation that allowed us to, you know, steal the ball, you know, get a layup. I think we even stole it a second time. And then what occurred was, after that timeout, he said, listen, guys, you know, they'll probably get the ball in. And I remember him specifically saying that. And he says, we're going to have to foul immediately. And it was me who fouled. I believe the young man's name was Kramer, who was like a high percentage free throw shooter. And you're thinking to yourself, oh my goodness, you know, they're going to make this thing and it's going to be ice, because there was no 3-point line at that time. And, you know, sure enough, he misses. We get the rebound, call timeout. And I remember going one way and Walter going the other way. And Mitch, I believe, made that pass and it banked in. And, you know, I keep telling my family, I said, look at the guy who's jumping up and down. That's me. And it was great. But I remember thinking back, we had been in so many tight games over our career at North Carolina. The poise that Coach Smith had in those situations was, you know, it's amazing to watch a man that, you know, never got excited and was pumped up, but yet poised to tell everybody what needed to be done. And that's why in my 4 years, I never thought we weren't out of a game. I said, we have a chance. We have a chance to come back. And especially after your freshman year, you're down 8 with 17 seconds and win the game in overtime. But, you know, he was a very special coach in so many ways, and especially in the game situations.
Did you realize as a player, as soon as that game was over, what your team had just accomplished, and that it was the kind of game we'd be talking about 46 years later?
Not really. I knew it had been special. I think there were a number of people that had left the arena. And the funny story is, my father, God bless him, was at the game, and he had to go to work that Monday, and he was a Russell Stover candy salesman. Okay, so he was going to a drugstore to sell candy to a druggist, and he knew who I was, and he knew my dad, and he said, "Hey, I'm so sorry about Carolina." And my dad looked at him and said, "What do you mean?" He says, "Oh, they lost, and that was a tough way to lose." He said, "No, they didn't. They won." And so you forget. And again, when I say something like that, television back then, you know, we were on TV a lot. But back in the day, television, you know, with basketball games and stuff, it was just starting to evolve. And it was pretty special when my dad could tell him, "Hey, no, they won." The guy looked at him like he was nuts. But no, fans leaving, fans coming, trying to get back to the game, it was special.
Your dad was probably like, "Look, if they won, let's check the score. You have to buy this many boxes of candy if the Tar Heels actually won this game."
And Coach Guthridge had a sweet tooth, so we bought them all.
John, you were a part of two, in addition to 8 points in 17 seconds, two other moments in Carolina, one really positive and one that is a tough one. One, the 75 ACC tournament, where Carolina came through, had a bunch of close games and won the ACC championship. I'd just be interested in any recollections that you have from that tournament, and then also the 77 championship game against Marquette and your memories of that.
Well, I think the 75, you know, we were very fortunate to have won that. And, you know, those were great wins. And the one story, you know, you start looking at all of a sudden a guy like Brad Hoffman and, you know, people like that were coming in and trying to win keep their season going. What I remember most is, you know, us coming back and I believe it was against Wake Forest.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden that became the game where all of a sudden the ball hit the scoreboard.
Yep.
And, And I'll never forget that we did whatever it took to win that particular game. And, you know, you have to have things go your way. And we had everything go our way. And Brad Hoffman, I don't know how great a shooting game he had, but he hit a big shot at the end to either tie or put us in the lead. And that game, I specifically remember saying, wow, we're sort of destined. And that was a team that I felt even we went on in the NCAA tournament that year, and I felt that we could have very easily, you know, it was one, you have to be lucky, you have to be good. And we didn't have the luck when we went up to Providence to play in the NCAA tournament, and we ended up losing against Syracuse, I think, that year. And I felt, you know, hey, we could have very easily gotten to the finals that particular year.
How about that Marquette game?
You have to bring up some wonderful memories and stuff like that. Leading up to that, there were so many things that were so positive. The one thing that my career and you know, I was very blessed to have had great teammates, people that, you know, you have the greatest high. I had the greatest high school coach, and I had the greatest college coach. And also I had the greatest teammates. And that particular year, we had so many people, you know, next man up and come through for us. And, you know, that game is something that I still gets under my skin. And it was a tough game to lose because, you know, I don't think in the beginning we were good. And, you know, we had Tommy Lagarde, we had Michael Korn, we had Walter Davis, Phil Ford, and myself, and we had Dudley Bradley coming off the bench, Jed Dowden, who, you know, Dave Colescott, Tom Zalagaris. We had a, you know, a strong bench that the guys came up and delivered. Having said that, you know, losing that game was very difficult because we wanted to give Coach his first national championship.
Sure.
What you just mentioned, all the great players who were on that team. What was it like to be a Carolina basketball player on campus in Chapel Hill in the late 70s? You weren't putting everything you did on Instagram, but people were by that point completely in love with Carolina basketball. What was it like to get to do that?
You know, it was interesting. I reflect back to my freshman year, thinking we were getting ready to play a blue-white exhibition game, and I think we were doing it during Thanksgiving at that time. And I'm saying, there's no students. No one's going to be in Carmichael. I said, let's see what we got. And running out and whatever Carmichael held from 7,000 to 10,000, depending on who you wanted to talk to, it was packed. And I said, holy mackerel, this place is special. And, you know, that you could tell the love for Carolina basketball in a situation like that where all the students were gone. No, it was totally packed. I don't think that every game we played at in Carmichael, it was a packed house. So having said that, you know, we were just very fortunate. We lived in a different time that where you don't have Instagram, you don't have all the social media situations that it was, but a lot of the players were pretty popular at that time too.
John, what ultimately led you to Carolina?
It was interesting. They didn't start recruiting me till a little bit later. And like I said, I went to Benedictine High School in Richmond, Virginia. I played for Warren Burlidge, who I considered the greatest high school basketball coach of all time. And there were certain level of things that I did there that I thought translated into what Carolina appreciated. And so I believe, you know, one of the first people probably to see me play was Eddie Fogler. Mm-hmm. And he recruited me, and Coach Smith came to one of our practices, and you know, he liked what he saw evidently. And, you know, once I had an opportunity to sit down and chat with him, I knew exactly where I was going to go. I didn't even come to the campus. I already knew. Having said that, you know, seeing Chapel Hill and witness it, you know, everything that it, that, you know, the school represents. I mean, I went to Benedictine as a Catholic military school, so it was the first time I'd seen women, you know, on the campus, and I started laughing, and I was fortunate enough to meet my wife, you know, and you know, we've been together over 42 some odd years, so she's gone through that journey, and recognizing, you know, hey, there's a lot of positive that have come out of being in Chapel Hill.
So you have had really a life in basketball since. Played in the NBA for a couple of years, assistant coach, college level, head coach, your head coach of the Pistons for a couple of seasons. What led you to want to stay in this sport and coach for decades?
Well, it was interesting having been mentored by my high school coach and then Coach Smith. I mean, you recognize the impact that they had on people. And really, you know, Coach Smith not only had an impact on players, but also people of Chapel Hill and the state of North Carolina and all over the country. So, you know, it was something that I said, you know, each year that, you know, ended up speaking to Coach Smith after your, you know, season, your season ending meetings, especially my senior year, I remember, and I said, what do you want to do? And a funny story is this. At that time, he said, John, what do you want to do? He says, I said, Coach, you know, I want to play in the NBA. He says, well, you know, you're going to have a chance. And he knew exactly what to say to me to get me excited. And, of course, I wanted that opportunity and was fortunate enough to be in the right place, right time, and going to Kansas City. And then the second thing, he said, well, you know, when your playing days are over, what would you like to do? And I said, well, I'd like to coach. And he looked at me straight in the face and says, well, that's great. He said, what level would you like to coach? I said, well, I'd like to coach college. And he says, good. He says, but you need to start off in high school. And, John, I got to tell you one thing. You're not going to make a lot of money in coaching. And I said, that's all right. You know, I'll be fine. I know I love the game and stuff like that. But this is how smart Coach Smith always remembered everything he said. Because I think it was like, you know, years afterwards. And I had gotten into coaching. And I was coaching in college for a while. And then I got into the NBA coaching. And he looked at me. And when I'd come down to one of the basketball meetings that we always had with all the coaches that were from Carolina and certain other selective people that had coached. And he whispered in my ear, he says, you know what? Do you remember your senior meeting? I said, yeah, I sort of do. He says, remember when I told you that you can't make a lot of money in coaching? I said, yeah. He said, I lied. he says, you can make money in coaching. And so, but that goes to show you back in the day, really, you didn't make a great deal of money and you didn't do it for the money. And then all of a sudden, look at what basketball is today. And I know there are a number of coaches out there that, you know, basically would say to you, and they're being honest, you don't do it always for the money. You do it for the love of the game. And it's true. You did do it for the love of the game. But I always laughed at that Coach Smith would remember that conversation and repeat it back to me.
You mentioned those the meetings in the summer, the coaching sort of summits that Coach Smith would have with all the folks from the Carolina family tree who were in coaching, and sometimes a couple folks who were not necessarily part of the tree but kind of honorary members. What were those like to be part of? What kind of ideas were thrown around, and what did you feel like you got out of it?
Well, first of all, it was very humbling to be in a room that you had some of the greatest basketball minds talking basketball and listening to different ideas. Because as much as we believed in the Carolina system, players would come, our coaches would come back and have a wrinkle to what a shooting drill or a defensive drill or an offense, you know, offensive set that you wanted to talk about and dissect. And you really, that was, you know, probably some of the greatest moments I had in basketball was listening to all these people talk.
How would it work? Would Coach Smith stand up at a chalkboard and say, "All right, guys, now we're gonna talk about half court defense"? How would it progress?
I'm sure Roy could tell you even more so because he was so exposed to a lot of these meetings. But what I recollect of a lot of the things that we did was, Coach Smith would be somebody that stood up and, he would have an agenda and we would carry out a lot of the things that he wanted to talk about. And he might even have a particular idea that he wanted to throw. But it was really an open forum for a lot of the coaches to be able to communicate on ideas of what their team is going to be like and or what his team is going to be like. Because, the thing about college coaching is, from one year to the next, or definitely in the next 4 years, things can change drastically. But it was very exciting.
So you've seen or coached college basketball. You've coached NBA basketball. What do you like about the pro level compared to college? Because you were in the pros for so long. What did you enjoy about coaching at that level of basketball?
Well, I think one of the things that in the NBA that you had to realize is it's 24/7 basketball, and a lot of the things that are happening in the college game today, you're allowed to teach more than you probably did in the past because the rules have changed where you have summer situations and are able to take four teams out to the Bahamas or whatever. But I think this is where, when I was back in 1990, getting just, my feet wet, video coordinator / scout for the Boston Celtics, the one thing you recognize is really it was truly, 24/7. How do we get better at that team and preparing for the next game? And you didn't have to worry about classes or you worried about, what was going on in a dorm or whatever. But this is where you looked at the NBA. And, of course, the big dramatic change is, 40 games, from 30 to 40 games in college to all of a sudden you had an 82-game schedule and preseason and hopefully you were in the postseason, which I was very blessed to have been in.
You worked with some incredible players. Allen Iverson, you were in Cleveland with LeBron James. I think also what is that coach player relationship like at the NBA level when you're working with these guys who are incredible players and incredible stars?
Well, each one was different and they all had their own personality. And, you talk about when I first started off in Boston, I was a video coordinator / scout, those first 3 years or 4 years, whatever. And that was the Bird, McHale, and Parrish times, and when the Celtics really were, a very talented team. And I think that's one of the things that, you look at each team that I went to have been able to have been in Philadelphia with Iverson, and I was in Orlando with Dwight Howard. I was in Cleveland with LeBron. And then you look in New Jersey, and I was with Vince Carter, Jason Kidd, and Richard Jefferson, who were very talented. And then you keep going back and forth with all the groups of players that you have coached, and you sort of pinch yourself. And each player did have a different type of personality and what was going to motivate them to be the best. And a lot of times they didn't need a lot of motivation. They just wanted to know what was on the game plan, have an idea of what needed to be executed, and then giving them the freedom to do it.
What do we not understand about Allen Iverson?
What you don't understand about Allen Iverson, one is pound for pound, has been described as probably one of the greatest players of all time. What separated Allen from a lot of players, in my estimation, was the length of his arms, the size of his hands, and his heart. His heart was, as a competitor, as a runner, you know, I think it was interesting. Larry Brown took the job over in 1997. Okay. And we came down here, and Coach Brown, you know, loved doing a lot of things that Coach Smith had done in the past. And one was running the mile. Allen had never ran a mile before. Well, what I remember of it, and not being able to specifically say exactly what time he did run, but he ran one of the fastest miles I've ever seen, and a guy that probably didn't have running shoes, and then went out and played 3 hours of practice basketball and never looked like he was tired. And that was one of the things that he was somebody that really, when it came lights time, and the lights turned on for that game, he was as competitive as anybody you would want to be associated with.
You just kind of touched on this a little bit, but I'm not sure people would have connected it. So you were with the 76ers when they were in Chapel Hill for training camp when Coach Smith retired. Is that correct?
That is correct.
What do you remember about those couple of days and how things unfolded?
Oh, it's interesting you said that. Coach Brown was always looking for different ways to do things, okay? So, and what I mean by that is secondary break or you know, any type of offense that could make us better. Well, what occurred that particular day was Larry Brown says, I want you to meet with Coach Smith. I said, okay. He says, go over secondary breaking and dissect everything that you can with him. I said, okay. So we had practice that morning. I went up to, I asked Coach, I said, Coach, can I, you know, I have some time with you? Absolutely. We sat down for over 2 hours, drew up secondary break, all the plays, whatever. And I do have that piece of paper that he with me, not with me here, but of course in a very safe spot.
I'm glad you don't have it with you here, because we'd create a diversion and then it would disappear.
That's right.
Yeah. But it was amazing that he was, you know, here's a man that's, you know, so busy as it was, spending 2 hours with me and going over secondary break. And, you know, he had a distinct way he wrote things down and stuff. And then Coach Brown looked at me and said, getting ready for the second practice that night. He said, John, did you have a chance to meet with Coach? I said, yeah, Coach, got great stuff. I'll let you look at it and whatever. We get ready to practice. We're going through all of our stuff that we're doing. It's around 7:30, 8 o'clock, and all of a sudden I get a tap on my shoulder, and it's Larry Brown. And I said, yeah, Coach, what's up? And I'm thinking I did something wrong. But he said, you're not going to believe this. I said, what do you mean? And he said, Coach Smith's going to retire. And you think about, I had just spent 2 hours with him. Here he is. That's the type of person he is. He would give back to the game, give back to his former players, anything that they want. But here is the day that he was going to retire, and he's spending those kind of quality time with me. And then, sure enough, he announced that he was retiring. And after training camp, we were supposed to fly out to go to an exhibition game, and Coach Brown and myself and I think one other player, George Lynch, I think stayed, and we stayed for his press conference.
How do you think he's impacted you as a coach? Not necessarily on the personal side, because I know there's a lot of impact there as well, but as a coach, what do you take, or what did you take from his teachings?
Coach Smith?
Yes.
Attention to detail, all the factors that go into what a practice plan was, what it was in preparing your team to become the best that it could possibly be. Listening to his, you know, pre and post game situations, how he handled timeouts, how he handled the team. There are so many ways that man has not only touched me, but touched everyone. It was very special to have had him as a mentor.
You told us about Allen Iverson. What do we not understand about LeBron James?
Well, I tell you this, if you had told me when I was coaching him, I think people are recognizing even more is how smart he is. I mean, you know, right now he is one of the greatest players to have ever played the game, but his basketball IQ was off the charts, even at a young age. I was amazed that he could play every position, and he knew every position, and he knew other teams. You would come back after the next day of playing a game, and you were preparing for another team, and you would say, this is what they're going to do, and he would already know what cut that another player was getting ready to make. And or he would come to me because Mike Brown, who was coaching Cleveland at that time, the head coach, you know, he had me doing a lot of in-the-game situations. And LeBron would come after seeing something that the Celtics or some other team had done. And he says, Q, did you see exactly what they did on this particular play? So, no, he was a student of the game. And watching him develop as a human being is quite impressive.
What was your experience like as a head coach, those 2 years in Detroit and trying to be the head man of a team? What do you remember from that experience? What did you like about it? What was difficult about it?
Well, you know, everything is challenging. And, you know, you go through times that all of a sudden you would hope. The reason I love Detroit so much is the 1 year that I was there, we won the championship. And, you know, all the when you get your opportunity, you want all the pieces to the puzzle to be there. And, you know, I hadn't been back in 5 years because I was coaching other teams and stuff like that. And you know, it was a great experience. It was one that I wish we had done better. But, you know, the relationships and people, some of the people that we had, you know, just it wasn't the way we wanted it to be at the end. But I tell you what, what a great city, what a great environment for college, for NBA basketball. And, you know, again, that year didn't work out, but we did get a ring. And that's the one thing that I always remember.
I wanted to ask you about one other player, and it's Vince Carter. So he recently became first player ever to play in four decades, I think, in the NBA or something crazy like that. When you had him in New Jersey, what did you learn about his game that maybe you couldn't tell just by watching him on TV or watching him from the opposing bench?
There wasn't much that I didn't know about him, but I didn't realize. The one thing that did stick out is watching his range. You know, one of the things, there's one thing to be able to shoot a three-pointer. Vince was one of the few guys to take a normal jump shot from a half-court line. And, you know, he did all those insane things in regards to being able to leap like anybody. You know, it was incredible. But his competitive spirit, watching him want to win, do whatever it takes to win, was very impressive. I mean, people don't realize at one stage we were 3-13 in New Jersey, okay? And it was a very testy year. Then we made a huge trade to get Vince, and we made the playoffs with that team. Now, again, Jason was coming off of an ACL tear, and then when he came back and Vince came into the equation, which with also Richard Jefferson for part of that time, that was a 1-2-3 group of young men that made the game very easy. And they were so talented, so gifted. I mean, we were a matchup nightmare for a lot of teams.
You've been around a lot of really successful coaches throughout your successful coaching career. Have you, and I know they're all different individually and different personalities, is there something that you found that is a common thread for guys who achieve at a really high level in that profession?
Well, I think one of the things that occurs in all levels is their level of communication with the players and getting the maximum potential out of each and every one of your guys. And Larry Brown, Mike Brown, I mean, I have been with a group of coaches that are Hall of Fame. And each one of them, I mean, brought something to the table that was so impressive. I mean, Lawrence Frank's attention to detail, Mo Cheek's ability to communicate with players, ML Carr communicated and, you know, had a love for the game. Then you had, again, Mike Brown, who we went to, you know, went to the went to the All-Star game, had the best league. He got Coach of the Year. You had Larry Brown, who we went to the finals, won a championship 1 year, went to the All-Star game. His ability, those people had the ability to communicate, but they also had special skills that were second to none.
If you could go back right now and tell 17-year-old John Kuster, going to Carolina is going to change your life this way, what would you tell him?
Go there. I think
don't mess it up.
Don't mess it up. I think, you know, you really don't realize how impressive the Carolina family is out there. I mean, it is, like Roy said the other night, it's as strong as it's ever been. We are so blessed to have Roy as our coach, because I see, you know, so many of Coach Smith's tendencies in him, that he cares so much about everything that goes on with the team. And it also translates into the people where I used to go all over the country. And they, you know, they wanted to know about Coach Smith. They wanted to know about UNC. And I think our reputation out there was second to none.
What would people in the NBA ask you about Carolina? Because we always hear players who go to the pros say, people always go and say, what is it about you Carolina guys? What would they say to you, and what would you tell them?
I know I shouldn't say this, and I hope I don't get in trouble because it's not true for everybody, but we liked our coach. it was very interesting. They looked at me like you like your coach? I said, no, I love my coach. He was the best. Why? I can call him right now, and he'll be in a meeting and he'll take my phone call. That was, you know, it was one of the things that I recognized more than anybody was, you know, there's a common thread in that whole picture when I was in the NBA, and that was Coach Smith. And Coach Smith was the reason that North Carolina, you know, was on the map in my looking back at basketball. So I would definitely tell John Kuster to go to Carolina, and especially if Rory's coaching.
Last thing, at least for me, Coach Williams, as we are sitting here having this conversation, is at 879 wins, same as Coach Smith. It has clearly been a very almost awkward, kind of bittersweet achievement, I think, for Coach Williams. For somebody who knows both of those men, I'd just be interested in your opinion on if that number matters and what they've both been able to accomplish.
Well, you know, it's interesting because it speaks volume about Roy's ability to be into this, you know, to be coaching this long. Plus, it couldn't happen to a better person. I mean, you know, again, when I think of Coach Smith, now I think of Roy Williams. And so to have two people that are always trying to do the right thing, you couldn't have a better person. You know, records are known to be broken, of course, and when Krzyzewski beat Knight and stuff like that. You have the same scenario with Roy, you know, going over a coach's number. And you couldn't be more proud of what Roy represents.
Appreciate John Kuster's time here on the Carolina Insider. And before we get to Adam's list, a reminder not to let your outside chores or projects to cause you to miss any of the Tar Heel game action this year. How can you do? How you're sitting there going, Jones, how can I not let those outside chores get in my way? LS Tractor, my friends. It helps make short work of those chores, from normal yard maintenance to larger projects as well. LS LS Tractor has the machine for you. Visit lstractor.com to see the difference. LS Tractor, what is it about for you? Adam, do you have a... Oh, you know what? Before we get to the list, we, as we are recording this, we do not know the result of Carolina versus Florida State women's hoops. But Adam, what a great win for Courtney Banghart and her team against NC State on Thursday. Tar Heels have an opportunity for another win over a ranked opponent. Again, you already know the result. We at this moment do not. But regardless of what happened in that game, Adam, some very clear progress being made with Carolina women's basketball in that Courtney Banghart has come in and she's starting to have this team fall into her identity a little bit. And man, they're fun to watch, playing well, and big win.
And I think we talked about this in one of the last couple episodes. Roy Williams has said one of the toughest jobs he had was when he came in and had to coach players who didn't necessarily come to Carolina for him and may have had different dreams or goals than what he was trying to get them to buy into. Courtney Banghart's doing that same thing, and I think it's pretty clear that they are buying into what she is trying to get them to do. And I think that's the sign of a really good coach. State's good, and so a win over them is a big deal. They were undefeated. They're one of the best teams in the conference. Carolina's not one of the best teams in the conference yet, but you can see the trajectory that would get them there. And I think that's what's encouraging.
You know, and Courtney Banghart is very, at least from what I have seen when I have seen the Tar Heels play, which isn't a ton, but I have seen them some, you know, they're much more deliberate than they have been in the past, but they're not real deep right now. And so I'm guessing that that probably has something to do with it. But a little bit of a slower pace, and they move the ball really well. They tend to get good shots for the most part. I mean, I've been impressed with their half-court work when I've seen them play. And again, I haven't seen a ton, but they tend to get good shots. And obviously, that's one of your goals.
And they've got a chance to be top half or better of the ACC.
Yeah, this can be a tournament team.
Very well could be, which would be a great year for them.
Yeah, big step forward, and they have a great recruiting class coming in. So, little what up, Coach Banghart, here midway through her first year with the Tar Heels. All right, Adam, your list.
What's on the top of Adam's list? Brought to you by Top of the Hill, where Tar Heels come to celebrate.
I think that it would probably be appropriate to start off with a vacation from life. This is just a little thing, but sometimes that's what a vacation from life is. Sometimes things are weighing you down, and then a little thing happens, and you think, nice job, whoever did that. My vacation from life is, you know when you're typing something in on your phone, like filling out a form or whatever,
mm-hmm.
and it gets to the part where you've got to like type in your zip code or your phone number. And when you do that, the numbers come up instead of the letters. You know what I'm talking about?
Yes.
Like on the keyboard. That's a vacation from life right there. I know that only saves me like half a second having to not shift over to the number keyboard. But I feel like whoever programmed that in, they were thinking about me when they did that. Like, Adam, I know you don't like shifting over to the numbers keyboard. I'm giving you the numbers keyboard right here. It's right coming to your phone. You don't have to do anything. Let me make it easy for you. And I lose a little respect when I'm filling out the form. And clearly, like, I have to enter the zip code. That's only numbers. But the numbers don't come up. You weren't thinking about me, programmer. And I lose a little respect for you when that happens. But that's beside the point. A vacation from life is when they think about me and I'm able to put numbers in without having to shift keyboards. Sometimes it's the little things. How do we feel about LSU canceling class yesterday and today? 2 days of class canceled for them to play in the football game against the Clemson Tigers.
I feel like it is not a surprising decision.
Carolina plays in national championship games fairly regularly, and unless I'm mistaken, does not cancel class. Now, sometimes students elect on their own not to go.
Sure.
Which I respect. But I think it's a little different when the university says, we're going to play in this football game and we're not going to have class for 2 days.
Well, you got to watch the game and then you got to recover from the game, Adam.
The game's at 8 o'clock at night. Who's going to class then? What's stopping you from going to class at 10:30 in the morning on Monday? I mean, I think we know the answer to that.
I wonder if, and I don't know, I wonder if the game, if part of the reasoning is the game is so close and they're trying to give their students an opportunity to go to the game. And I don't know, I'm guessing.
Could be. You received a valuable gift at the Clemson game?
I did.
A your very own G College name tag, which was presented to you in a ceremony worthy of such a gift.
John and Mary Chandler presented this. Adam, I'm holding it up. If you're watching on our gold feed right now, you can see. Adam, it is so official looking.
Yeah.
Like, it looks like the name tag that a doctor would have on.
Yeah. Like right above the breast pocket
yeah.
On his white coat.
Yeah, where it says like Dr. Adam Lucas,
right.
MD. It just says G College, aristocrat of tenderness. This is, Adam, I'm glad, where should we, this needs to go up in Pod World headquarters.
Well, I think.
And it's magnetic.
It's magnetic, yeah.
So we could probably get it on one of the classy shelves.
Yeah. You got a lot of options due to the magnetism.
So, John, Mary, thank you. This is going up in Pod World headquarters. As soon as Adam and I are done recording, it's going up and we'll be here in perpetuity. Did I use that word right?
Sure. On the Halloween and Christmas storefront.
Yep.
And now you may have done your own research, but pod correspondent Scott Maitland has also looked into a Christmas store near him and says it's empty at the current time, but I think he said that he could foresee a day when there might be bunny suits in there.
Yep, I as well checked it out. Can confirm it is currently empty. You must, if the pop-up stores own it for multiple or lease it for multiple months or just lease it all the time, man, you must really be raking in the dough.
Have you ever gone to...
No.
Like the pop-up Christmas store, like, I need some Christmas stuff. Let me go to the pop-up Christmas store. Have you ever done that?
No.
I never have either. Who's doing this?
The Halloween one is the one that really is the more curious one to me.
That there's that much of a market for
yes.
Halloween goods?
Yes.
I kind of agree with that. At Christmas, everybody is always like, oh, I could really use that strand of lights.
Yeah.
Let me just go to the pop-up store. But Halloween, are you ever like...
Past a costume.
Right.
What else are you buying? I don't know.
And those stores aren't small.
No. Well, I mean, blow-ups, obviously.
A lot of inventory.
I mean, we have Halloween blow-ups. You know this.
Yes. As it relates to the Roadhouse Challenge that's coming not today, but in the future, two things. Number one, there was a surprisingly overwhelming winner.
Ferris Bueller's Day Off. That'll be coming next episode.
The next episode. There was also a heated debate in our Twitter about Karate Kid.
There's only one Karate Kid.
Yeah.
It is Ralph Macchio.
I had this discussion with someone who saw the Twitter mentions trying to tell me that Jaden Smith is somehow the martial art equivalent of Daniel LaRusso. Daniel LaRusso is from Encino, the mean streets. He learned it on the streets, and he will take you down, Jaden Smith, the likes of which you have never seen. You don't know the moves he's got. Your moves came out of a book. Daniel LaRusso's came from waxing the car and painting the fence. with Mr. Miyagi. So don't think you're going to come in here with your book martial arts and do anything whatsoever to Daniel LaRusso. You'll find yourself on your back, my friend. And he will sweep the leg. So, the original Karate Kid is the one that was referenced in the poll. And also...
Right, why would I even choose to watch the other one?
I had honestly forgotten there was another one.
Yeah. I'm not going to watch that. I'm not going to watch that one.
There's not,
why would I watch that one?
There's not one thing from the remake that is in our consciousness at all.
Nah.
Other than I think Will Smith's kid was in it. I'm sure he's a fine young man. But don't you get in that squared circle with Daniel LaRusso at the All Valley Karate Championships. If you find your name up on the wall in the bracket opposite him, you best retire early, my friend.
I think you can probably sense the disappointment that Adam has that Karate Kid did not win the poll. But it will be up for vote again. And you just remember this rant when it is.
That's all.
Adam, a couple things from our Twitter feed. Sean Patrizzi, friend of the pod, says he is all in on your assumption or your assertion that slowing down a song makes it even better. He said whenever they do it with Hark the Sound, brings up instant chills. Maybe we can do that right now, Sean. Maybe it's playing right now while I'm talking. He loves it, so you're all in on that. You and Sean locked in. Ben Johnson.
It's a cruel, cruel summer. See how that was?
Yeah. Ben Johnston, excuse me, not Johnson. After the game.
Not the sprinter. Ben Johnson, the sprinter who was disqualified?
I don't think he's a listener.
Okay.
Ben said, this was after the game, he said, anyone making the trek home following the game, just go listen to the Freddie Kiger interview from November. You'll feel better because Freddie makes your life better. Yeah. Freddie is. He does.
Maybe I should do that.
Yeah. Go back, chill out, hear Freddie talk about Anson Dorrance. It'll be terrific. You know, Adam, we didn't really address the fact that Jeremiah Francis, I mean, you did mention it, but gosh, just another injury for the Tar Heels. And as Adam and I are recording this, we don't know the severity of the injury. It hasn't been announced. But, gosh, I mean, just, again, you hate it for the individual and you hate it for the team. And, man, I just, the hits keep coming in that regard for the Tar Heels this year.
And he had been so impacted by the injury to Anthony Harris. And we don't know if his is anything like that at all. I mean, certainly it's not like that because we saw the Anthony Harris one happen. But just so frustrating. Felt like he, even when he was in here talking, he talked about how he felt like he was getting a little better idea. And I thought what he said about how he knew he needed to play at different speeds, I thought that was really smart and showed that he really did understand how to play point guard for Roy Williams, and then all of a sudden you're back on the bench for at least one game. So, unfortunate for him individually, unfortunate for the team, definitely, and you hope he gets good news this week.
Okay. Later this week, the plan is Roadhouse Challenge.
Roadhouse.
I think I'm pretty confident that's going to happen, Adam. Ferris Bueller's Day Off, in the crosshairs of the Roadhouse Challenge. We have a terrific guest as well that I think you're really going to like the conversation. I hope you like all of our conversations, but I think you're really going to enjoy the one coming up later this week. And we'll preview Carolina and Pittsburgh. Tar Heels playing the Panthers twice in 10 days. And Adam will be jollier then as well. Maybe you like this, Adam, though. Maybe you like on fire, Adam.
I feel like I'm like a political pundit getting ready for the election or something. Like, my head's in the little box on the screen, and over here next to me is other guy in the box, and he's got diverging views from me, and I've just got to make my points.
Oh, by the way, also want to give a little what up. To Arthur Smith.
Yeah.
We mentioned, we've talked about Arthur a time or two, but Titans offensive coordinator, former Tar Heel offensive lineman, and of course the Titans with the big win over the Ravens on Saturday night in the NFL playoffs. And, man, Titans are hot. They're a team you don't want to see right now, Adam. And, man, Arthur Smith doing a great job.
I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility that Arthur Smith might be an NFL head coach in the next year or two.
No, I'm sure.
That's how the progression seems to go.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure with the Titans doing what they're doing, his name's going to get in the mix for openings here in the next year or two.
And we've been told that he'd really like to come on the pod. So
first interview post-head coaching job is going to be with us.
Yeah. Well, I figure when he's on the field after the Titans win the Super Bowl, he will have gotten us tickets, and we'll go out there and do it right there as the confetti falls around him. Derrick Henry, out of the way. We don't have time to hug Arthur Smith right now. Nice job with those 47 carries. Now, Arthur, we need you to say, see you later, big grits.
It all started with Eric Mondra. We were eating breakfast in Memphis. Adam, anything else?
No.
No. No more. Sack. Just doesn't have lettuce. All right. We're going to let John Kuster and the RZA get us out of here. We'll see you on Friday on the latest edition of the Carolina Insider.
I'm John Kuster. See you later, big grits.
When I was small, we had nothing at all. We used to eat grits for dinner.
Pound box of sugar and a stick of margarine. A hot pot of grits kept my family from starving. Steamy hot meal served less than 5 minutes. Big silver pot boiling water salt in it. House full of brothers and sisters, the pot's missing. Pilgrim on a box on the stove in the kitchen.
When I was small, we had nothing at all. We used to eat.
See you later, big grit.
The preceding has been a Learfield IMG College presentation of the Tar Heel Sports Network.
1, 2, 3, 4. Those are numbers, but you already knew that. If you want to know what number you're going to pay each month for your car, use Kelley Blue Book My Wallet on AutoTrader. They're really good at numbers. AutoTrader.